This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. I had a chance to speak with my friend Dan Widmeyer. He's the co-founder and CEO of Bolt Threads, which is an extremely ambitious company that looks to disrupt the garment industry through technology and science. During our conversation, he shares his perspective on sustainability, the future of the environment, and how to focus on the task at hand instead of distractions. I really enjoyed this, as I hope you do too. This is Dan Widmeyer. Tell us just a little bit about Bolt Threads, where you've been, where you're heading, and then we'll get to some sort of more personal questions.
I'll look forward to that part. Bolt Threads is a technology company with the idea of using the tools of biotechnology to tap into 4 billion years of life on Earth as source material for new materials we can use in consumer products. And so the idea here is that life's been around a lot longer than us humans, invented a lot of great things from evolution, in fact, invented and reinvented them. With Bolt, we're going to use biotech and use it as a platform technology to bring those things forward to meet critical unmet needs for performance and sustainability in consumer products.
You know, we've known each other for a few years now.
Let's go with a few. Yeah.
I think we started our companies at the same time.
About the same time, yeah.
We were even speaking earlier. Do you think, I kind of feel like we're necessary for each other. Not necessarily even just you and me, but I feel like there's a community of companies that do kind of hard tech that don't fit a normal Silicon Valley type mold. Do you feel that at all?
Well, yeah, it comes in two flavors, I think. There's one, and I think this is very observable when you operate a company that persists for more than 5 years. You notice that a cohort emerges of entrepreneurs who have gone through the founding and many of the trials, and they're different for all of us, of nurturing.
Strangely the same sometimes, though.
Well, there's a whole bunch of features that are the same company to company, but when you experience them and what they are can change from company to company, founder to founder, but they start as cohorts. I mean, you saw this with, Slack, Pinterest, and someone else of that breed, Twitter, let's say, that were roughly around the same cohort. Those founders all know each other, and they kind of turn to each other for advice. I think the same was true of our companies. And then you had the second cohort, which is doing things that are really hard and don't actually fit the venture model in the beginning when you're taking true science risk. I mean, anytime I say biotech, it's like, is that medical? No. What the hell are you guys doing? Like that's not settled science yet. You've got lots to figure out. And I think that's part of where many of us deep tech companies bond, you and me and all of our friends who do things that are hard and off the beaten path.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's been 10 years that we've been up to this. We both came,
who's
though.
Counting?
Do you ever forget that we were scientists at one point? What I mean by that
is, I get asked a lot. Do I miss doing science?
No.
And I never know how to understand the question.
Okay. No, how about this? Is this what you expected when you started a company to be a CEO and not to be a scientist in a company? I think about this all the time. I remember for me it happened that one of our investors, our largest investor, said to me, I said, I think I'm going to be the chief science officer of the company. I'd like to raise some money. I'd like to be the chief science officer of the company. He said, no, you are the CEO of this company, and you're going to be the CEO for a long time. I remember being kind of terrified by that, and I think I was a bit right to be terrified by it. But did you always since the beginning think that you would be a CEO, and is it anything like you thought it would be?
So, no, not in the beginning. Like, we kind of drew straws, and I was the CEO, partially because I'd roped my two co-founders into starting this company and had done even this tiniest little bit of leadership there. I would say within 2 years, it became clear that it was going to be very hard anytime soon to bring in an outsider who could do the job with as much conviction and passion as I could. And so the only option left, and had some other investors who you probably know quite well, who were like, no, you're the CEO of this company.
Maybe the same people.
Yeah. Who knows? But the idea that, well, someone's going to be in charge of this thing, and if you're going to do it well, that's your job. Your job is no longer to do science. The job is to be a leader and to be a professional CEO, and that I am not, right? But I better damn well train and study and learn and get good at it. And it was very hard in the beginning. I don't know about your experience, but I found it very difficult to understand what I had to learn. It felt like there's just an overwhelming number of new things, which when your brain feels like it's melting down and you're learning a new skill set, you're often making a lot of progress, but there's a lot of pain involved. That was a healthy phase of the last 10 years of that. Now it feels like it's slowed down quite a bit for me. New challenges, but it's slowed down quite a bit. And so to answer your original question, you know, when we started the company, my understanding is I was biting off any job necessary to make this work. If that meant not be the CEO in the future, great, we'll do that. If it means drop science and be the CEO, do that. Now, in fairness, I'm a fine scientist. I'm not the best scientist in the world. The when you recognize the moment where you can hire people who you knew from graduate school or have met since that are smarter, better scientists than you, that's the right. I mean, that's obviously the right answer. It just takes a little while to get emotionally right with that, I think, as a scientist transitioning to a management role.
Yeah, I heard somebody, I don't remember exactly who it was, say that it's impossible to be a CEO of everything in a company. You're either, I think, a product CEO or a marketing CEO or a finance CEO. Where do you put yourself in that? Of course you have to do a bit of everything, but are you a product CEO?
You know, I've thought about this a lot. I think there's one way to think about it where you put it in those types of categories: product, finance, marketing, messaging, that kind of stuff. If we were to say that for Bolt, I think I lie firmly on the strategy side of things. On the flip side, I think the real job of the CEO, when done really well, is essentially be a coach. You're essentially coaching a team and trying to make them act like a team and not just a collection of talented individuals you've put together who nominally report to you, which is a very standard mode of CEOing a company. It's like, yeah, I hire smart people and they like have their verticals and then we all complain about silos, right? My job, as I see it, is to get them to function, bond, act like a team and solve problems together that transcend simply what they're good at.
Do you think that your responsibility is to handle the pivots? I mean, I wonder about this. We both had in our companies, I think, times when we have adjusted business models or focused on one product more than the other. Even
sure.
Is that what you mean by strategy? You would start to pull the team together and say, this is something that we're going to now focus on that we didn't before?
Again, that comes in two flavors. One of them is, as the founder CEO, you and I have the moral authority and the credibility in an organization to say, we're stopping doing this, even though we like it and we can do quite well at it, and we're doing that because it's the right call for this company. And you don't have to think of that yourself as the CEO, but you're the one who has to make the decision. When I talk about strategy for me, I love breaking down the totality of the information we have in a fast-moving environment on a decision and be able to figure out what everyone is thinking, how to craft the best path forward, whether that's a product decision, a science decision, a scale-up decision, a financing decision. There's just a whole lot of places where one of our mutual friends has a pretty good saying that a bad plan's better than no plan. Being able to craft it, something close and resembling a good plan very quickly, I think, is the name of the game. I think in a startup, actually, you hire amazingly talented people, and it's kind of like the best ones are somewhat indistinguishable from the okay ones.
Yeah.
Because the only thing that really puts you in a bind as a startup is when the clock is ticking down. It's like sports. You can watch any NBA player drain three free throws or three-pointers before a game when no one's in their face and they got infinite time. You put them in a game and it gets hard because there's just time bound. And I think it's the same for startups. You put this time bound constraint on a startup and you have very little time to understand a fast moving environment, come to a conclusion and know you made the right bet and execute on it like you made the right bet.
Yeah. I'm going to jump into actual Bolt Threads products and strategy a little bit, but not in any deep science level because I can't keep up with you. I have fully become a CEO and forgotten that I'm a scientist. So,
I pretend I moonlight as a scientist once in a while, but that's the extent of it these days.
So when I first met you, I thought about Bold Threads the way that I would think of a materials company, of a great materials company of the past, of a DuPont. And I thought of you and your inventors like a Crothers who was inventing nyliners. This is what I pictured you being. And now you've kind of become a brand as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in how you think of whether you're trying to create a new type of thing, a new type of material, or you're trying to create a brand for Bold Threads itself?
They go hand in hand. You can't do one in the 21st century without the other. You're trying to build a business that's going to stick, that consumers can understand, that breaks through the noise, and that screams brand no matter what you do.
Okay, then what kind... Okay, let's take the fashion side of it.
Sure.
Do you... You know, right now you're creating... Tell us a little bit about Milo, and then this will lead into it, hopefully.
Sure. Yeah, so we have a product we call Milo. Was unveiled in 2018 with our friend Stella McCartney in London at the V&A Museum for an exhibit. And it's basically taking the root structure of mushrooms called mycelia, these thread-like materials that make a non-woven. We then grow it and process it into something that... looks and can work in places where you'd use real or artificial leather.
So you mentioned Stella McCartney already. This is very high fashion. This is haute couture.
Yeah.
But I also, when I think of Milo, this incredibly environmentally friendly product, this is incredibly important for the next generation of materials, for the next generation of clothing. If it's to scale, is it do you see that you can have haute couture like a Stella McCartney, which this sort of car equivalent would be maybe a Tesla or something, or a more Uniqlo H&M type model that you want to, that is necessary in order to scale?
Oh, around? So we're a mission-driven company at the end of the day. Yeah. We want materials to become more sustainable for a planet that's in climate crisis. That's the core of our mission at the end of the day. Does that mean we have to do better on performance for materials and do well on cost and scalability and all these other things? Yeah, those are necessary ingredients, but that core of the mission is sustainability. If you're going to be sustainable, you don't just sell to the top of the pyramid, to the luxury brands. Now, they're an important piece, and I think they're one that the world watches for a signal. Part of the reason you see us show up there in a lot of our messaging, because I think people are paying attention there, and it's an achievable target to hit some of the necessary things you have to do as a startup. How do you find a small market with reasonable margins with which to launch the product and figure out how to get it right before you go to scale? Scale is hard for everybody in every single facet that you can imagine, as we both experienced. So, the long term is you want to be everywhere, but you have to start somewhere. And the idea for us was that actually, the founding thesis 10 years ago, we haven't talked about this that much, was the data is pretty unarguable, if you're going to play scientist, at least by moonlighting, that the release of greenhouse gases by human activity is leading to a change in the climate that leads to specific acute problems in people's day-to-day lives, whether it's the enhanced wildfire seasons we see in California, whether it's more intense hurricanes in the Gulf Coast or in the southern United States, or you just go around the world and find where specific problems come up that are consequences of climate change. Our take in the beginning, and part of why we went into consumer, was a belief that over time, as those become more acute and more obvious to individual consumers across the planet, the demand for solutions and things that can represent solutions will reach a fever pitch. And that's, I think, what we're starting to see.
And you thought about this in 2009 when it was still climate change. It's only been really climate catastrophe conversation in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
But you were thinking in those terms even 10 years ago?
I mean, the trend was unarguable, right?
Right.
Unless we're going to make a drastic shift in how much carbon we emit, you were going to go from change to catastrophe at some point. When? Arguable. The point was, at some point, that's going to happen, and that's going to drive a difference in the selective pressure by consumers and what products they buy. So back in 2009, and part of why in the beginning it was very much performance, 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 is because that's what consumers wanted, it's what brands wanted. No one wanted to pay more for sustainability. This was the clean tech boom's lesson. Today, that's not true anymore. That has turned on its head. Consumers, there is a
some of the hottest companies around.
Well, and you see this in consumer attitudes as well. I mean, we saw a piece of data recently. I'm going to butcher this, but it was something on the order of 3/4 of consumers across it was something like China, Australia, U.S., United Kingdom would pay more for a product that was better for the environment. That's like that is the opposite of canonical logic for the last 40 years of marketing.
Is it converging incredibly for you right now, I guess, then? Just as Bolt Threads products are about to scale, so has the public's willingness to spend for saving the environment.
I'm not terribly surprised that those things have synced up, because I think in the beginning we were always focused on performance, but at the end of the day, and we can make great performing products, and there's a lot of future you can go to there. Biology is a tough nut to crack. It's not a mature science for making materials and consumer products yet. And we've made a lot of progress. We've gotten much further. But when that flip happened from performance to sustainability, it was going to pull us along in the thing we're best at since 2009.
Right.
And so I'm not terribly surprised that's happened. But it is. It's all converging in a way that I think is leading to a very interesting next decade for companies that can make products with more sustainable practices. In fact, one of the things we did early on, and we can't talk to you about it too much yet, but I can say we did it. We built a full lifecycle assessment model of Milo so that we can look at that internally and guide our improvements. And I think we actually went back. We used a third party for this.
Nanotronics can't see this?
Yeah. Maybe Nanotronics can see it at some point. We're going to publish it at some point to say everyone hold us accountable to this. The first time we saw it, all of our sustainability went back into to the third-party provider who built the model for us. And they're like, I think there's an error in this. I think I want you to double-check it. It was just like so much better. And so I think we're sitting here going, we're going to drive on this. We're going to live and die on these models of environmental impact because that fits our mission as a company. And that's going to drive our science, our new product development. I mean, the technology when we first met, right, is this technology for going into biology and playing with proteins. And the search space is somewhere in the order of 10 to the 175th power. That is so big, you have to make some hard choices on what you're going to go after. So why not use something like sustainability, a life cycle assessment, to drive what we go after?
Okay, then let me pull you out of a Bolt Threads only mentality, or Bolt Threads as the only company that could save the world, which...
No, not true.
Bolt Threads could be a really big part of it.
Correct.
Because clearly what we wear... being sustainable is incredibly important. What are some other technologies? And this could go back to talking about how we had friends that were in hard tech businesses. Maybe it's some of those. What are some other technologies in the world outside of what you do that you think could be important to this ecosystem of creating a better world?
I mean, I think if you're in this business of impacting 7 billion consumers across the planet, and you've got a shot clock, a very short timeline with which to do it for climate crisis, I really hope Bolt's not the only answer out there, even in our own space. I actually hope there are lots of players, just because of the distributed effect of scaling and how slow scaling happens in companies. Even when it happens at breakneck pace, it's slow. On a time,
do you feel it's slower than it used to be?
No, I think it's fast. I think it's faster than it ever has been before. It's still, we've backed ourselves into quite the corner with the climate crisis in terms of time to act in a measurable number of decade. Let's be generous. An immeasurable number of decades to avoid some of the worst impact.
It's a constraint for you, like you were saying before. But this is a constraint for the planet.
Correct. And the idea that any one company is going to be global scale and make a material that impacts each of 7 billion consumers in a decade is just unrealistic.
So, what are some others?
So, you know, I get excited about anything involving energy. Energy and electrification and how we source our energy is probably the biggest nut to crack. Bolt is not the biggest thing out there to help the future of the planet.
Oh,
right. I mean, I'd like to, you know, Dan, CEO, yes, Bolt's the most important company for all this. But realistically, it's energy, right? You don't need to take too many classes in thermodynamics to say it's energy. The most heartening thing, I think, that came out of the clean tech boom was the fact that it's kind of mundane now to make cheaper power from solar and wind than any other than coal or any other fossil fuel.
Yeah, there's actually no reason anymore other than commercial reason to not do that.
And kind of amazingly, the outcome was not that someone cornered the market and created a mega cap monopoly out of it, but that it became just the de facto standard, and everyone could, in a distributed way, scale it up. I think then what happens with automotive, I think we need to see a lot of electrification beyond simply the great work that Tesla is doing in this space. And it sounds like a lot of people are picking up some serious efforts. I think chemicals is, Bolt kind of toes the line a little bit on this, of where chemicals lie and where consumer materials pick up. Chemicals is a really hard nut to crack.
There hasn't been enormous amount of innovation in our lifetime, certainly, in chemicals, do you believe?
No, and that's part of, well, one, I'm not surprised as a chemist, because we found the solution spaces pretty quickly that were somewhat obvious to us, and we're going to have a hard time getting out of those local minima. But the when you look at something like chemicals, most innovative businesses are venture funded today. It's the model of choice for driving innovation, and replacing a chemical that already exists and is mostly good enough, mostly commodified, is not a place for venture to live and be a healthy model, a healthy ecosystem. And you see this in waves where companies that are essentially commodities get funded by venture and it ends up in somewhat predictable catastrophe.
I've been thinking about this, that you, myself, others were part of this venture-backed community being very different than a normal... You mentioned this other generation, even though they might be our age, of companies that came before.
Never mind. Why you gotta go there? Why you gotta go?
I'm sorry. But there are, I'd say, you know, internet companies or ad tech companies, things like Twitter.
Things where scaling is much more straightforward than some of these deep tech companies, and don't have pure science risk the way we do. That, in my mind,
it's
pure
kind of hard
science
to judge. It's sort of hard to compare us in the same place, though. I'm wondering if the venture model has yet priced it right or yet thought about what it means. So you have these constraints of this environmental catastrophe, mm-hmm. potentially. You have the excitement of new hard science that wouldn't have necessarily been hard for a previous generation if society got behind it, that are left in the hands of VCs that made a lot of money on the types of companies you were talking about. You have been more successful than most at being able to marry the venture world with the hard tech world. But is there a different model that we should be looking towards? I mean, should government be more involved? Should more lifestyle businesses be trying to do new things and us not have to hold the standard of, you know, 100x returns? Is there something else that comes to your mind that might be useful if somebody else is starting a company? Forget Bolt Threads. Mm-hmm. You've gone down this path successfully. But I want to encourage other people to do this too. We need to mentor other people and have other...
I think nothing is clear and obvious as the better way yet. You can say things, you got to play a realism effect or a filter to this. And it's like government funding vastly more research at an institution level driven towards solutions sounds like a good one until you think about trying to make government do anything fast. It's just a, and that's not how it has to be. It's just more about the pragmatism of where we are today.
I've asked
the end of 2019.
Yeah, I've asked a few people this before. Do you think that in 2019, soon to be 2020, if polio was a problem, that a Salk could be funded and could get these types of results as quickly in the United States?
No. I think what's happening is we're finding areas of technology where this innovation can come from, whether it's in nanotronics or a Bolt Threads or a Impossible Foods or, you know, pick something like this. And you're solving problems that require a scale of capital that government has not proven willing to deploy for seemingly mundane level results. Since Salk. Yeah, I mean, if you think about it,
maybe the Human Genome Project.
But even that wasn't that expensive at the time, was it? I mean, it was a big commitment. And it was also somewhat low-hanging fruit. We're all coded by our DNA. Let's read it for the first time. That's a noble and laudable and easy to get behind goal.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think, though, about, I watched a talk of yours recently where
what did you I talk say?
if what you would say in a talk wouldn't be the kind of thing that would be so shocking that I would bring up here. I will also come up with other things. But you were talking about partners you have in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't necessarily just apply to Europe, but those companies did not necessarily follow a VC model. There's a long history of whether it's family businesses or, you know, legacy businesses that involved craftsmanship, multi-generational,
mm-hmm.
Dedication. Don't you think that there might be a place for that still in our world, even in the United States, in a place where we think Silicon Valley drives everything?
No, certainly, and I think actually pretty alive and healthy. It could be healthier. And you look no further as a proxy for this to Shopify, right? There's a business that is thriving off of being a platform to essentially small entrepreneur-led businesses being started all over the country. Now, none of those are going to be, the next Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates in all likelihood because of the way those small business entities are structured. And for better or for worse, in the United States, we've started to champion, maybe this will change, but champion the people who start things and become, you know, the richest person in the world.
Yeah.
I think it's more about what we market.
Yeah,
focus on.
I'm so torn about it because the largest part of me wants to do the biggest things possible. I want to solve the biggest problems. I see both utopias and catastrophes, and both call out for doing big things, and it calls out for big capital. And, you talk about abundance and all of these things. This is what I'm mostly driven towards. But at the same time, I'm very attracted to seeing how when you're talking, you're working part of you sort of have one hand in science, but it's also in fashion, mm-hmm. which there's this history of craftsmanship. Also, so there's something very human that I'm attracted to that isn't just about the enormity of the types of things that we talk about on a daily basis. And I sometimes wonder if we lose our humanity to not think about those things. And you're in a position where you do get to think about those all the time.
Yeah, and you're not constantly reducing everything down to the biggest, simplest problem you can. You have to tangle with the complexity, which comes with plenty of headaches. I think it's one of the things where if you're trying to tackle a crisis that is of our own making, right, well, at least we can admit that climate catastrophe is a crisis that we created, it's going to require all of us to pitch in to actually create a solution that's lasting and durable. And so it's a necessary place that you have to tangle, but it's messy and it's hard and it's frustrating and people have their own opinions and want to do things their own way. But if you can convince everyone to generally pull in the right direction, it's going to be a lot more powerful than any amount of push a single company can generate, even a very powerful company. Think about a company like Amazon. They didn't really hit the bend in that hockey stick until they opened Marketplace and let everyone else play on their platform.
Yeah.
You can't do it. Maybe it's the enduring lesson.
And that's
is,
what
no,
you're going
no
to
matter
be
how talented and smart and great yeah. you are, you can't do it all yourself. You know, the talk you're referencing, I was talking about some of our supply chain partners
right.
from Milo, and we're happy to open that up to a collection of people who help produce for us, and they're going to do well, and we're going to do well together, rather than a whole bunch of Bolt-owned factories that we have to, like, pour our heart and soul into and manage all over the world. Let's make people make a bit of money, economic reward, while solving this environmental problem. And Bolt gets our part as well in providing the technology and continue to improve it as we scale.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for talking to me, Dan. I always love spending time talking to you. Till next time.
All right. Thank you, Matthew.
Thanks.